The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today is Rick Sharga. We're going to address a little different topic that we've done before here on Lifetime Income, the role that real estate has in your retirement, the influence of the real estate market and how it is changing and how it differently affects various groups such as baby boomers, millennials, and Gen Xers. Hopefully this will be a special show today. The subject matter of today's show was really prompted by an actual case study, which we'll discuss later on in the program. There are a number of issues we've often brought up on the show, but in today's show, we're going to demonstrate how important these issues are and why it is important to plan for them. So let's begin with four key issues that are having a major impact on baby boomer retirements in ways that are catching many, many retirees off guard. So let's talk about these, what you're calling the four horsemen of the retirement apocalypse and their impact on most investors' retirement plans.
You know, these are a number of issues probably, John, we have discussed in one form or another over the last probably 2 years, but the four issues we're going to be talking about and we'll demonstrate their impact when we get to this week's case study, because that's what kind of triggered this. I had sort of an uncomfortable meeting this week that was sort of a reality check for a particular client that was dealing with issues where eventually, if nothing was changed, he was going to run out of money. So all of these impact everyone's retirement plans. And these issues were really driven home, as I mentioned, as I had to deal with the long-term client's change in personal circumstances. And we all know from the day we retired, let's say you retire at age 65 to the time you pass away, along the way, over decades, there are going to be changes in your personal welfare. It may be circumstances, it may be health, it may be financial markets, as we've undergone here in the last 10 years, actually the last decade, where we saw two major bear markets, including, for the first time, a drop in real estate values. So we want to address here today the four factors that are altering retirement environment for just about everyone. In one way or another, these factors are going to impact you personally in your retirement. If you haven't thought about them or you haven't incorporated these issues into your retirement plan, you could actually find yourself ending up in financial difficulties, as my client did, later on in your retirement. And these key areas are troubled issues are 1, longevity, 2, medical expenses, 3, financial repression in the low interest rate environment. I mean, think about it, folks. You are witnessing today the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded history. And, you know, obviously that is impacting you and the returns. And 4, something that is gaining widespread recognition among economists is our operating economic environment, which is referred to as stagnation.
Let us divide each of these issues up and examine them one by one, because we need to drive home exactly why they are an issue with a real life experience, which you've had to deal with this week with some of your clients, Jim.
Let's begin with the issue many retirees are dealing with today, thanks to advances in medical science, which is longevity. Social Security was put into effect in 1933 and implemented in 1935. John, the life expectancy of a male was 65 years. You were basically, you hit Social Security, collect a couple of years worth of checks, and then you passed on. If we look what's happened to longevity over the last century, longevity has increased lifespans by over 20 years. So instead of 65, life expectancy is now 85. In fact, you could end up spending nearly 1/3 of your adult life in retirement. So what that means is you will draw down on your assets over a much longer period of time. And just as in your working career, which was spent in what we would call the accumulation of assets, your retirement years are going to be spent on the drawdown of those assets. So if you're age 65 and retired, between you and, let's say, your spouse, you need to think about living off those assets and make them last for a good 25 years, and just keep your fingers crossed that neither one of you ends up in a long-term care facility that could end up running $80,000 a year. And I want to bring this up. One of the greatest risks to retirees in terms of expenses, John, is when one spouse ends up getting institutionalized, or let's say the need for long-term care, and the other spouse as well. Because what you're doing now is maintaining two households. You're maintaining the well spouse's household. The well spouse may be living in the house that you have, and then the spouse that needs care, like long-term care, is in a facility. So you're really maintaining two households, and I can't tell you how much of a drain that would put on anyone's budget.
Yeah, it's not the only issue of living longer, but we also know we're going to run into medical issues, which with today's advances not only can prolong life, but also carry higher medical costs. And if you're relying on government programs like Obamacare and things to do it, you may be balefully surprised later on.
And that brings me up probably to the second horseman, which is medical expenses. Now, there have been a number of studies done on how much out-of-pocket expenses you will experience throughout retirement. Some of the major mutual fund companies, in fact, the largest ones, Fidelity and Vanguard, have done studies on this very issue in terms of out-of-pocket expenses. And that number runs somewhere between $230,000 and $250,000. So if you are retired today, let's say you're age 65, between you and your spouse, you need to add to your budget an additional $10,000 a year that you need to be putting aside or have the means to pay for, because later on, probably in the last third of your retirement years, that's when all those medical expenses are going to come home to roost. Now, unfortunately, John, there's this myth that has developed, and I've seen this in a lot of the Social Security statistics on the Social Security website, is somehow people believe that between Social Security and Medicare, these expenses are all going to be covered. Truth be told, Medicare is only going to cover about 60% of your medical expenses, which is why you need a Medigap insurance policy. And even then, you're still going to be faced with out-of-pocket expenses. And I want to point out, the $230,000 to $250,000 figure does not include long-term care, which can run as much as $80,000, and here in California, probably $85,000 a year. That's a lot of money. And so it's not just the medical expenses of $230,000 to $250,000, but John, you take the average stay in a long-term care facility is about 3.5 years, multiply that times, let's say, $80,000, and you're talking about another $250,000 in addition of out-of-pocket expenses. So you can see how in the latter part of your retirement years, how these things can come back to bite you if you haven't made sufficient plans for them.
Let's move on to number three. The other issue which retirees have to deal with is the fact that interest rates are at the lowest rate in recorded human history. As a matter of fact, we should just point out things are sort of messed up.
And <we're, laughs> that's probably the best way to point it out.
Yeah, let's make it more technical here. They're messed up people, and they're going to be messed up for some time to come. That's a very profound thought, as a matter of fact, especially when you consider that, I mean, interest rates haven't been here before, at a time when individuals are living longer and depending on living off of their assets over a longer period of time, the return on safe assets has never been lower. It's just a horrible combination of events. So at the same time that you would want to have a reasonable, safe return on your money, that return no longer exists on safe assets. So retirees are forced to go outside of their comfort zone and then take on risks. Whereas before, the goal, Jim, if you recall, if we go back to the 70s and 80s, was to retire with no risk. In other words, everything was guaranteed. The checks rolled in every month and you were just fine. Right now, a lot of people haven't planned on this type of thing, the rocky ground we're on, for the period when they retired.
John, it's not just the fact that investment returns on what we would consider safe investments, let's say short-term bonds, CDs, treasury bills. You know, I can remember a time when I used to get 8% on T-bills. You know, those days are long gone. You're lucky if you can get a quarter of a point today on a three-month treasury bill. But we've been in this low environment for close to 8 years now, and we are more likely to remain low interest rates for the balance of this decade. I mean, I don't say anything right now in this disinflationary environment that we're in that we're ever going to get back to those high interest rates that we used to enjoy, you know, well over a decade ago. But there's another element that is also impacting retirees, which is what I call the macroeconomic environment. And this isn't the 90s when, you know, stock markets went up double digits each year. You used to get 7-8% on safe bond investments. And I mean, that was a pretty good period of time to retire. I mean, the market was going up double digits. If you were an income investor and had money at a bank or treasury bill, you were getting 7-8%. I mean, those were halfway decent returns. And like Professor Robert Merton from Harvard, I interviewed him about a month ago in his new article he wrote about the coming crisis in retirement. And he really demonstrated that when he talked about $1 million. Now, everybody thinks of $1 million. Wow, that's a lot of money. But in 2000, that $1 million brought you $80,000 of income. In 2016, that $1 million only brings you about $17,000 of income if you want to stay in safe investments. So we're in a much, much different macro environment today of what some have called stagnation. Others call it the new normal. It's an environment of low economic growth, low inflation, disinflation in many ways. And that's the new term. Bill Gross coined the term the new normal. Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, calls it stagnation. And the investment implications are a low investment returns on asset classes. And we have seen that since the fall of 2014 when QE stopped, when the Fed stimulus basically put a damper on creating liquidity or pumping liquidity into the asset markets, which were keeping them elevated. In many ways, QE 1, 2, and 3 accounted for this economic recovery and also the recovery that we saw in asset classes because interest rates were unusually low. That money had to go somewhere, so it went into asset classes, pumping those assets up. Well, that ended in the fall of 2014. And if you look at a chart of the S&P 500, the stock market has virtually gone nowhere in about almost 17, 18 months now. So, you know, the problem is, without that Fed stimulus and that liquidity, the market is having a very hard time, especially with the rising dollar, with corporate profits peaking. And now we're seeing a slowdown in the economy and the possibility that next year we could be heading into a recession. So, you know, unfortunately, the returns on assets, whether it's stocks or bonds or even safe investments like treasury bills and CDs, they're just not there because we are living in a stagnating economic environment. We haven't got the first quarter GDP numbers, but I suspect when they come in, we're lucky if the economy grew at 1%. It grew a little over 1% in the fourth quarter. That slowing trend is continuing. The Fed is projecting that the economy will grow at 2.4%. If you take a look at the slowdown in the fourth quarter, the slowdown in the first quarter, the economy is going to have to grow at almost 3% a quarter for Q2, Q3, and Q4. I just don't see that happening. I don't think we're going to hit 2% this year on economic growth, which means a couple of things. Slower economic growth means that interest rates are more likely to stay lower, as John Kosar and I discussed on the weekend program. And number two, with the economy slowing down, that also has implications for a slowdown in the stock market and corporate earnings, which means, you know, stocks are going to have a hard time appreciating unless investors are just simply willing to pay more for every dollar of earnings.
Well, there you have it, the four horsemen of the retirement apocalypse, which are impacting over 73 million baby boomers. I should point out, by the way, Jim, is we're facing these four, whereas in times past, you could rely on maybe government assistance if needed. That's going to go away as our government bangs more and more into its own crises of unsustainability. And that one isn't on the horizon of a lot of people either. But the ones we're talking about today are living longer, higher medical expenses, lower interest rates, and lower economic growth. So I'm assuming we're not just saying the apocalypse is here. There's a new show on that one too, You, Me, and the Apocalypse, if you've been watching. And obviously, we wish to offer people some hope in this. What do retirees need to do?
It's something that is sort of the theme of this program. You better have a retirement plan that takes into account these four factors that we've been talking about here. The problem today, John, is 70% of Americans don't have a plan and mistakenly believe Social Security and Medicare is going to take care of it. And unfortunately, for most individuals, Medicare will only provide about 40% of their retirement income. You know, the lower your level of income, the greater percentage Social Security makes up of that retirement income. If you have more income or you have larger expenses, Social Security is going to provide less of that. So, you know, people think that, oh, I don't need to worry. The government's going to take care of me. And take a look at the election this year. That's what a lot of people believe. I mean, take a look at those voters that think that they're going to get free medical and free college, as if we have the money to pay for that. And according to a number of studies, most Americans fail to save enough for their retirement. They don't have that emergency fund, or they have inadequate insurance, whether it's medical insurance, life insurance. And as happens to many boomers prior to retirement, they have spent far too much on college education for their kids at a time when they should be socking away money. And according to studies, most people really don't get serious about planning for their retirement until their latter 40s and 50s, you know, basically after the kids have grown up and gone off to college. So we are dealing with a different kind of environment today that is less secure. John, you think of your dad, your mom, and my parents. I mean, they lived in a time when you worked for a company 25, 30 years or 40 years, you retired, you got the Timex watch, you had a defined benefit pension plan that covered between 70 and 80% of your working salary, and then throw Social Security on that. Between the defined benefit pension plan and Social Security, you pretty much had your retirement expenses covered. Then you had Medicare, you had maybe medical insurance. You know, if we look at the three-legged stool today for retirement, which is made up of Social Security, pension, and savings, most retirees in the future are going to have to rely more and more on their own savings to take care of these needs, because the government, as we've seen, as you call it, John, the great reneging, the government is reducing more of the benefits it has promised, whether it's Medicare or it's Social Security. So in the years ahead, you're going to see more reneging on a lot of the promises that have been made, despite this year being an election year when the politicians are actually offering more stuff that's going to be free. We simply don't have the money. And unfortunately, in an election year, we have a media that isn't asking the hard questions. How are you going to pay for this free college? How are you going to pay for all this free medical for everybody? Oh, we're just going to tax rich people, and then you won't have to pay. Hate to tell you, folks, there isn't enough rich people to pay for it. It's like Margaret Thatcher's old saying, the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money. So the point we're making here is you better have a plan, take into account these factors. The fact that due to medical technology, diet, exercise, you may live longer. You may live to 85. There's a good chance 25% of you will live to be in your 90s. Number two, medical expenses for seniors are going up between 6 and 7% a year. And number three, low interest rates. We've been in a low interest rate environment for 8 years. It can go on a lot longer, folks. Look at Japan. They've been in a low interest rate environment for 25 years, and now they've gone to a negative interest rate environment. So you're going to have to look to yourself to take care of all those promises that have been made by the government, many of which will end up being reneged on over the next decade.
And all of this just gets us back to the point that we frequently thrum here on the program, is that you better have a plan. The one aspect, by the way, that I've observed, I guess more or less as an impartial observer doing the program, is that there are so many more obstacles today, Jim, to retirement, and yet there are so many more options that can be used to solve these, from Social Security options to working in retirement. There's a lot of studies that have been done that shown people that do something in retirement that's purposeful, that can not only augment their income, but gives them purpose. They tend to live longer, as a matter of fact. And there are investment and tax options. So overall, if we look at it, there are options and can help resolve or mitigate these issues that we've enunciated here on the program. But they do require that an individual take action. And the unfortunate reality we have today is that most Americans procrastinate and they wait until a crisis arises. Then you are thrown into a panic state. And if you look at my mother's generation, you know, my dad, who was an accountant, set her up very well by the time he died. And for many, many years, she was able to collect yields. It was largely in treasury instruments or things related to that, where once again, there was that guarantee we were talking about. You had a pretty steady flow. But over the years, mom wasn't too much into finances and understanding it. You began to see the yield from that go down. Now, she did have a military pension as well from my father, etc. So what we ultimately wound doing is mom wound up moving in with us. And we actually anticipated that when we bought our house here, that this would happen. So we were adding space on, etc. And that's becoming more and more common. You know, there are some contractors now that are building multi-family homes. They're building homes with a mind of having several different generations of a family living in the same household. So those are all things that you have to watch.
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the biggest new trends with home builders here. You know, they'll have like a home that has a 3-car garage or a 4-car garage. And one of the options is to convert one of those garages into living quarters. And guess who would be the person objecting to that, John, are the environmentalists. They're trying to put a stop to it. But we're seeing that here, especially in the Asian community, where you're seeing multi-generations in a single household. And that's one way that we're coping, as we'll talk here with Rick Sharga, as we talk about the housing market and the difference between generations, the baby boomers who are now downsizing, heading into retirement, and the millennials, who many of which are still living at home with their parents. So it's an experience you're going to see more and more of. I have a client who last year, their mother had a stroke and had to be put into a retirement home, John. And as the disease progressed, she has Alzheimer's, it got to the point where she needed level 3 care. There just wasn't the level of money between the family and the mother to pay for those expenses. So now mom is living in the home of one of the brothers, and there's nursing care that comes in during the day, but it was one of the ways they were able to afford and take care of this situation. So you're seeing more and more of this, where family members, the boomers, are taking care of parents and having their kids still living at home, despite the fact they've graduated from college. So it's a different world today, and you better account for these kind of things or have a plan or a contingency plan, as we'll see in a case study we're going to discuss here, because these very issues are real and they're not changing. You know, low interest rate environment is going to be with us for a long period of time. A stagnating economy is going to be with us for a long period of time. Medical science continues to advance, and the cost of medicine continues to go up, and people are simply living longer.
So let's recap one more time just before we move on to this week's case study. The four horsemen of the retirement apocalypse that can really devastate anyone's retirement plan. You have to think about this. Number one, we're living longer, longevity. It's funny when we have to consider that a negative, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be like, when you think about it, when Social Security was put into place, John, men only lived 65. I mean, I've got clients in their 90s, and one approaching, I'm trying to think how old she is. I think she's going to have her 97th or 98th birthday. So she may very well be a centenarian.
Yep, exactly. And that's going to become more and more common. Okay, number two, medical expenses, because while medical care increases as longevity goes up, then the need for medical care goes up. Number three, financial repression. We're at historic low interest rates. As I said before, if you want to boil it down to something simple, it's all messed up. What do you want? You know, and it's going to be messed up for a while. So you have to deal with it in terms of that, plus economic stagnation. And that's probably not going away anytime in the near future. So those are the four things that you have to think about when you're retirement. Don't let it daunt you, you know, to become daunting to the point that you can't deal with it. There are ways to handle all of this. Now, this week's case study is going to be more more extensive because it covers these four issues of the retirement apocalypse, so to speak. It's an illustration of why unexpected events can alter your retirement plan. But it also illustrates why having a retirement plan gives you the flexibility and the ability to react to any of the surprises that life can bring you. So, Jim, let's discuss this week's case study, which became a theme of the entire program, as always with our case studies. The life experiences are real with real clients, but we withhold their names to protect their privacy.
You know, this case really drove home the point for me this week, and it's one of the reasons we're doing this show. We'll just call this the case of Joe and Edna Turner. Actually, Edna passed away last May. Joe and Edna have been clients of mine, John, for probably over two decades. Joe currently is in good health, but he's age 87. Now, they've been clients for two decades. They started with a retirement plan just before Joe got ready to retire. He was a gemologist. And so we were working. We had a retirement plan. We had a conservative-based portfolio. And as they headed into retirement, eventually they were going to stay in their existing home. They had downsized, which was one of the reasons they had built up some extra capital in which they could live on in preparation for retirement. So we already went through the downsizing that most baby boomers or couples nearing retirement, you sell the house that you raise the kids in, and then you use that capital to either buy something. Now, what happened is eventually they sold their smaller home in 2007. They were getting older. They moved into a low-cost retirement community further north because the expenses of the retirement communities were much, much cheaper than, let's say, in San Diego, especially along coastal areas where, you know, the expenses can run $7,000, $8,000 a month, depending on what kind of facility that you're in. So they moved into a modest one-bedroom retirement home. It had sort of a kitchenette, you know, microwave oven, a sink, and a refrigerator, but, you know, part of the cost of living in the retirement home included three meals. And their portfolio when they began retirement was roughly about 50% individual bonds, individual type stocks. Everything was designed to produce income because we did not have as many assets as Joe and Edna thought they were going to have. So we had individual bonds, we had utility stocks known for paying dividends, telecom stocks, consumer staples, the kind of income-oriented type of stocks that you would expect to see in a retirement portfolio. Now, one thing that came up last year that kind of altered the plan, and we talked about it, is the retirement home that they were living in built a whole new wing and a whole new facility. The new facility, they were much larger apartments. They actually had kitchens, granite counters, stainless steel appliances, and they wanted to kind of upgrade because they were tired of living in a one-bedroom apartment, which, you know, for many people that grew up in a nice-sized house raising a family, you go to a one-bedroom apartment, obviously it's a different form of living. So they wanted to move over to the new wing, which the only problem is the rent was going to go from over $3,000 a month to $6,500. And I said, you know what? When they made that decision, it was in 2013, the stock market was doing well. In fact, the stock market was up 30% that year. I said, you know, as long as markets hold up, you know, we could probably wing this, but it was going to mean taking a distribution rate of almost 15% a year. And I said, you know, the problem is sooner or later, 6-8 years down the road at this kind of rate, if the markets don't maintain this kind of rate of return, we're going to run into problems. We're going to be drawing down assets. And so that was a big, big issue.
Did they comprehend, Jim, the fact that they really could run out of money? You know, some people tend to go, yeah, and then go back to doing what they were doing before.
You know, the problem is, like anybody else, John, it's like Joe said, well, you know, we're probably not going to live that long, you know, because they were in their 80s when they made this decision. And it's thinking like, how much longer are we going to live? You know, thinking we're not going to live to our 90s. Joe's parents died in the 70s. And so here he was in his 80s along with Edna. So it's kind of this thing. This gets back to this longevity issue because of, you know, medication, because of advances in medicine, people were living longer. And so I said, all right, you know, but there's a risk. And I said, we better have a backup plan. And the backup plan was, well, if things really did get tight and they got sicker, or let's say the portfolio returns weren't as great, they could always move back to the other side. So that was sort of a backup plan. The unfortunate thing is Edna had colon cancer. She'd been battling it, and she lost that battle last May. And originally, after her death, you know, I met with Joe, because Joe was also getting older now. We also made his daughter backup trustee. His daughter was a CPA, very sharp with numbers, understood markets. And so that made a lot of sense should Joe, let's say, develop dementia or anything like that. But the plan was, I mean, when you lose a spouse, the last thing you want to do is make an immediate move. So the plan was towards the end of summer, he would move back to the other wing where the cost of living was much cheaper. In other words, he no longer needed a two-bedroom apartment. It would be a one-bedroom apartment would be much cheaper. The unfortunate thing, John, is that event never took place. In fact, along the way, I found out through his daughter, is Joe took on a roommate, which was a widow, a friend of theirs who had lost her husband, and moved in with Joe. And the way it worked is the second person moving in, they would pay $650 a month, which would be mainly to cover your food costs because the facility provided three meals a day. But she herself did not have the money to afford her own place. And so Joe was being generous, but the problem is Joe couldn't afford to maintain that because we're going through principal. We're not dealing in a market like we did between 2009 in 2013, when the stock market was going up double digits a year. In fact, the stock market has gone nowhere since 2014, not to mention the fact interest rates have come down a lot more since that time.
So this sounds a little strange, but he was getting himself into a situation that he really couldn't afford. And in the midst of that, he was taking on a roommate who herself needed some kind of support that couldn't pay her freight, so to speak, her half of the bill. Well, where did that go?
You know, unfortunately, it's not going to work out well for his roommate, because I met with both Joe and his daughter this week, and I just went through the numbers. And, you know, one of the things is he was a little bit perplexed, and he goes, you know, why are we drawing down my account more now when 5 or 6 years ago that wasn't a problem? And I said, well, Joe, 5 or 6 years ago, the stock market was going up double digits every single year. So you could afford to take this amount of money and you didn't really see the drawdown in your assets. But, you know, what do you tell a guy? And I go, Joe, the market did nothing last year. You remember back in the days when I used to get you 7% and 8% on your bonds? Well, I'm only getting you 4% and 5% now. Your utilities are only paying a little over 4%. Your consumer staple stocks are paying a little over 3%. But unfortunately, we're having to liquidate assets because he was taking a withdrawal rate of $4,000 a month, because the new facility was basically $6,500 a month. Joe's pension was $3,700 a month, and he's spending $8,000 a month. So I was having to provide $4,000 out of his portfolio, and we were drawing that portfolio down. And unfortunately, one of the events that took place when Joe lost his wife, Edna, last May, he also lost Edna's Social Security, which was half of Joe's, which was roughly $1,200 a month. So there was another $15,000 loss in income. And this is something that hits. You need to think about this if you're listening, husband and wife, that if both of you are living today where, let's say, you know, the husband was the main breadwinner, he's getting his Social Security and the wife is getting half of his Social Security. So you have two Social Security checks. Well, when one spouse passes away, the survivor gets the larger Social Security benefit, but he or she then loses their own benefit. So in this case, when Edna passed away, you know, Joe lost her $1,200 a month Social Security, which was $15,000 of income. And so the hard reality that we had to deal with this week, I said, Joe, you know, I understand she's been a friend of the family's, but you know what? You cannot afford to maintain $6,500 a month, $8,000 a month of spending. You simply don't have that money. And so, you know, that was a kind of a hard reality that we had to deal with. And the other thing I had to express to Joe, other than macular degeneration, I mean, he was still in good health, had a healthy heart, no signs of any medical issues at this time, and he's 87 years old. I said, Joe, you could live into your 90s. What are we going to do if you live another 8-10 years? What are we going to do when you don't have the money? And so that was the issue.
All right, so he's confronted now with the reality of the situation. How well did this go over? Were you able to achieve some kind of a workable solution?
The workable solution was something we had in the plan when he decided to move from the old facility up to the new facility, which was much more expensive. You know, we said if we ever ran out of money or, you know, we could not produce the income to support that, the backup plan was to move back over to the old wing, and which is what we're going to do. In fact, this week, they made an appointment to talk about moving out of his apartment back to his old apartment, which was over $3,000 a month. And by doing that, you know, we're going to be in fairly good shape because Joe, between Social Security and pension, had about $3,700 of income coming in. And between what he had left now, he was down to about his last $350,000 of assets, which I had a concern because based on the drawdown of $4,000 a month, we basically only had 7 years left. And that's assuming that markets didn't go down. So, you know, based on $350,000, the portfolio was producing income between interest and dividends of over $15,000 a year. So you add $15,000 a year to almost $47,000 in pensions, and you know, we were going to be okay. The fact is, I said, look, Joe, we're down to $350,000 worth of assets. That produces about $15,000 a year if you don't want to touch your principal. But at $4,000 a month, that's a distribution rate of almost 15% a year. And there's no way in this kind of market that we're going to be able to earn 15%. This isn't 2013 when the stock market went up 30% that year. So, you know, you could take out a distribution rate of 15% and not worry about touching principal.
And Jim, we're going to see a lot more of this in the future. We better plan on it because you can see the medical costs are going up, living costs are going up. And I mean, what happened to Joe's roommate here was really indicative of that. So it's more and more important that families begin, not just, you know, people, individuals, but sometimes families and their kids who are going to have to be actively involved in it, all start to plan as how they're going to handle these things. And that's why we do this particular program. Now, coming up next, our guest is Rick Sharga, the influence of real estate on retirement, how the markets are changing and how it's also changing how it affects baby boomers, millennials, and Gen Xers, and anybody else who's in there that doesn't factor into one of those groups. Is there anybody like that? I don't know. We'll find out. Anyway, as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, we know that sometimes demographics can drive trends in investments. For example, the baby boom population drove the housing market in the last half of a century. But what about the new market now, with boomers heading into retirement and the millennials? Is real estate being impacted? Joining us on the program is Rick Sharga. He is Chief of Marketing at 10X. And Rick, I want to talk about the impact of, I think there's 73 million baby boomers heading into retirement. I'd like to talk about, in your opinion, in which way is that impacting the real estate market? Obviously, they're out of the household formation stage. They're probably downsizing. Let's begin with the impact of boomers on real estate.
Well, Jim, the impact of boomers on real estate is not what we all expected it to be when we were doing our forecasts 5 or 10 years ago. We expected to have seen a flight toward downsizing as boomers aged and retired, and the first wave of boomers is retiring now. What's been a countervailing trend, and this really is a result of the Great Recession, is that we have the highest percentage we've ever recorded in 30-year-old and younger adult children living at home with their parents. And that has delayed what's probably still an inevitable move by those boomers into smaller properties, but it has clearly slowed things down. So we're beginning to see some movement, But until we see the percentage of those 30-something adults creating their own households, it's probably not going to be the full-scale movement that we've all anticipated for quite some time.
You know, that was one thing I noticed in the housing statistics coming out of the Great Recession, is that the new home buyers, which normally in past recoveries were a major section of the buying public, those numbers were a lot lower this time. So I guess that would reflect the very numbers you just talked about. And let's talk about the next generation, which is the millennials, because as the boomers are downsizing, which means they're selling the big home, they're moving to smaller homes as they head into retirement, then Rick, who is buying those homes? So let's say that I traded up over the years as the family expanded, as the family got larger, I got a larger home, maybe I had a 3,000 square foot home, 2,500, maybe 4,000. Who's buying those homes now?
That's the trillion-dollar question, Jim, is who's buying the homes that the boomers are going to ultimately want to sell. Let me take a step back for you here, because I think we all focus on the millennials, but we've lost a generation somewhere in between there. Remember when Gen X was the generation du jour, and we all talked about them? The Gen Xers entered the housing market at exactly the wrong time. They came into their prime buying age right at the peak of the housing boom, and actually at that point, had the highest home ownership rate in history of any age cohort, and then unfortunately got slaughtered as the housing market went through its bust. Normally, that group would probably be the ones first in line to buy the properties from the boomers, because it really is almost a linear progression. You go from your entry-level house to a move up, and then probably your third or fourth buy is the one that, for the most part, people settle into until they're ready to retire. We've effectively almost wiped out an entire cohort from that progression. Because that Gen X contingent now has the lowest home ownership rate of the various age cohorts. Many of them have elected to continue to rent now that there are more single family homes available for rental. And so they've kind of stepped out of their normal buying cycle. The millennials, who actually comprise a larger segment of the population than even the boomers do, are getting to market more slowly. They began coming out of college during the recession, so their entry-level jobs have come at a much lower compensation rate than previous generations did. They also are coming out with the highest amount of student debt. So what we're seeing with that generation, the millennials, is they're staying in college longer. They're not getting their first real job until later. That's delaying when they get married. That's delaying when they have children. And all of those are inflection points that typically lead to somebody buying a property. The research I've seen suggests that they still aspire to home ownership in similar percentages as previous generations, but they're coming to market just a little later. And in fact, the age of the first-time home buyer in the last 18 months has actually gone up by about a year, which statistically speaking is pretty significant for that short a period of time. But it's kind of a two-part problem. The Gen Xers have sort of voted themselves off the island, and the millennials haven't reached the island yet. And so there is this somewhat delayed response situation that we find ourselves in right now, which probably is going to work out okay since the boomers aren't selling in large numbers anyway.
I read an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, Rick, and they were talking about homes for sale in Los Angeles, and homes that were like what you would call, I guess, a starter home, $500,000-$600,000. They were on the market for less than a week, and they were bidding wars. And then they talked down the street where there was a $3 million home that took 3 months to sell and sold for less than the listing price. I think it was $3 million. It sold for a little over $2.75 million versus the $500,000 home that sold above market and was on the market for a week. So it seems like we're seeing this bifurcated market. Is that what you're finding?
Absolutely. And this varies market to market. So real estate is still, you know, pretty much a local game. But particularly in Southern California, what I've been tracking, and we're located in Orange County, California, first of all, there's very little inventory available anywhere for the entry-level buyer. The new home builders have stopped building that kind of inventory. New home inventory across the country is nearly at a 40-year low. And again, people aren't moving up as quickly as they have in previous generations. So there's just not a lot of low-end inventory available. What's selling like hotcakes is that sort of mid-range property set. In Southern California, it's probably anywhere from $300,000 to a $750,000 house. If they're priced appropriately, don't stay on the market very long at all. If you get above a million into the what most people would look at as more of a luxury buy, there's less of a market for those properties and they are staying on the market a little bit longer. And it's just no big surprise. The higher the price point of the properties, the longer it takes to find a buyer willing to make that kind of commitment. But it is weird to watch both the high end and the low end of the market suffer at the same time. And in fact, first-time home buyers, I think for the full year last year and into the first quarter of this year, have been right around 30% of the market, where a more healthy market is closer to 40%. So things have still not fully recovered from the volatility of that boom and bust cycle we went through.
So, Rick, as the boomers head into retirement, they're trying to unload the bigger house that they raised the family in, maybe take some of that equity out, downsize. Who's going to buy those homes then?
Two things, Jim. First, what I expect the boomers to do is, like they've done just about every other market, they're going to fundamentally change the dynamic of that last home, of that post-retirement real estate market. What we are seeing is a growing diversity in senior living facilities. So it used to be you'd either live in your own home, you'd move in with your family, or you'd wind up moving into a nursing home. And now we're seeing 55 and up communities forming. We're seeing assisted living communities forming at varying levels of assistance. We are seeing facilities being built where you have more dedicated health care as boomers age or as elderly folks continue to age. And then you'll have your more traditional, really medical facilities like nursing homes. So I think one of the trends we're going to see moving forward is as boomers move out, they're going to be looking first for more active communities and where the communities are actually built around their needs. We're seeing a lot of that in Southern California right now and in Florida, where sort of retirement is a religion. So we're going to see a very different set of properties and trends that the boomers really facilitate. I think ultimately who's going to buy these properties are going to be the millennials. I just think it's going to take a little bit of time. In the interim, we are seeing some of those properties being sold to investors. We're seeing properties going to foreign investors. China last year actually surpassed Canada as the country that had the most buyers of U.S. residential properties. And there's still a flight to safety from a lot of foreign countries where investors would like to park their money in U.S. real estate as opposed to other investment opportunities. And there's a growing rental market for those single-family homes. So it's not a bad investment. And then we're seeing institutional investors here in the States continue to buy up some of these properties and then rent them out to people who like the experience of living in a single-family house but don't necessarily want to buy or haven't had their finances recovered to a position where they can buy. So I think you're probably looking at a 3 to 5 year window where we still continue to work through what's left over of the disastrous housing market bust before we get back to something that looks a little bit like a more normal housing market.
So, Rick, you take a look at another trend that we saw in the last upswing in real estate in the last decade. There was a trend towards second homes, maybe vacation homes. What's going on there?
Well, it's interesting. I was doing some research getting ready for this, and last year we actually saw the share of vacation home purchases dip a little bit. It went from about 21% of home purchases in 2014 to 16% in 2015. That's still relatively high, historically speaking. And I know there are real estate professionals with entire practices set up to sell these kind of vacation homes and second homes. So it's still a relatively high percentage of the market compared to historical trends, but it does seem to be slowing down a little bit. They're typically not cheap homes. They're between $150,000 and $200,000. And about half of the time, people are looking to buy these things to use themselves, and the other half of the time they're looking to buy them as revenue-producing opportunities. And I would not be surprised to see a lot of boomers who probably have been burned a couple of times, going through the volatility of the stock market, rising and falling, parking some of the equity in their current homes into these vacation homes as better investment opportunities to help fund their retirement.
So in terms of this downsizing we've seen, one of the things that has impacted this retirement market is the low returns that we're seeing in the markets these days. I mean, you take a look at what you're getting in money market funds, what seniors can get in CDs or safe type investments or even treasuries. So doesn't that sort of dampen maybe some of the discretionary funds that would normally be available for like vacation homes with that demographic shift?
Great question. And logically, you would think yes. Having recently filed my taxes, I was surprised to learn that I'd made almost $15 in interest on my savings account last year. But keep in mind that the stock market has been trending in a positive direction for several years now, even with the rough first quarter it had in 2016. And the other thing that is true is if you happen to be one of those boomers who owned a house, your home value since about 2011 has been rising at percentages that far outpace both inflation and wage growth. So one of the best places to have had your money parked for the last 5 or 6 years really is in your real estate. If you were already in a positive equity position 5 years ago, and particularly if you're in some of the hotter markets in the country, you're probably in an equity position now where you can take some of that equity and invest in a vacation property. And again, you're talking about typically a more mature category of homeowner, which means they're probably making a little bit more money than some of the entry-level folks are and can afford to do something like that. So I think on the one hand, if you're looking at funding a purchase through, you know, your stock proceeds or what's been going on with treasuries or bonds, clearly that's more challenging today than it has been in other cycles. But if you happen to have been invested in real estate and didn't use your house as an ATM back during the boom and bust cycle, you might be able to tap into that equity to invest in more real estate.
I want to talk about another trend, too. We just talked about second homes and then the boomers downsizing. Something that you see all the time if you're watching a financial station is there are numerous reverse mortgage commercials. Is this only going to grow? In other words, as let's say some boomers are saying, you know what, I've been in this house for 30 years. I don't want to move. Our friends are here. I don't want to make a change. Is that something that you see growing in the future as well as some of these boomers have to tap into their house or the equity in that house as a means of living?
I do see that, Jim. I see that. I think the reverse mortgage industry is still pretty much in its infancy. I do know that a lot of the regulators, the CFPB in particular, are starting to take a closer look at how reverse mortgages are put together and some of the consumer risk involved. So I expect really to have two seemingly countervailing trends. I do think we'll see more boomers tap into their equity by using reverse mortgages. I also think they will probably become more regulated, in some cases a little harder to get, perhaps, than they have been in the past just because of regulatory bodies that would like to protect consumers and their families from inadvertently getting themselves into trouble. But yeah, as the population ages, as people live longer in retirement and perhaps hadn't planned as effectively from a financial perspective as they needed to cover their retirement age, it's almost inevitable that they'll look toward their house as a means of helping to fund their retirement.
So as this trend continues, overall, we know now, Rick, that the Fed has been embarking on raising interest rates. They ended taper a little over a year ago. They raised interest rates for the first time in December. We know that eventually, as rates begin to rise, at some point that will impact the housing market. So a final question, if I may, how healthy is the real estate market in today's economy?
Do you really think interest rates are ever going to go up again? I've been predicting for 5 years in a row that they're going to go up, and I've been wrong for 5 years in a row. At this point, I'm just going to predict it every year until I get it right. But when the Fed raised the Fed funds rate last year, we all expected rates on mortgages to go up. It's been fascinating to watch them go down, and now we're predicting that they might hit new historic lows before they bottom out. How healthy is the housing market? The housing market is probably three quarters of the way back. We're going to probably see between 5.1 and 5.3 million existing home sales this year, probably a half million to 550,000 new home sales. Those numbers are well off the bottom of the market. There is, in a lot of places, a little bit more demand than there is supply because a lot of the inventory just is not coming to market yet, and that's propping prices up. We should, given our demographics, probably be a little closer to 6 million existing home sales and almost a million new home sales. So we have a ways to go. I don't think we're going to get there probably until 2018 at the earliest. On the good news front, credit is probably going to start loosening a little bit as buyers really do try and either get their own credit scores in line or have a little bit more cash to put down to sort of prime the pump. And foreclosure activity is probably going to be back to normal levels by sometime next year. We're still at about 25% more foreclosure activity than we've seen historically, but the properties in foreclosure now are all on loans that really were issued before 2010, and we're finally seeing them work their way through the system. So more or less, the housing market is in good shape. An interest rate shock could screw things up. An economic downturn would be really the only thing I can see in the coming months or year that might derail the market. But the one cloud on the horizon I would offer is that we're probably going to hit an affordability wall in some markets The Bay Area looks like it might be suffering from that already. Southern California, Austin, Texas, a handful of markets around the country where prices have been escalating far, far more rapidly than wages.
So overall, you would say, given the shape of the economy, the housing market looks still pretty healthy. One of the things, at least I noticed in our area, Rick, that we just haven't seen the overbuilding like I did in the last decade, where you would have home builders would come in, they would start a subdivision, they would build like a whole slew of houses on spec. They've been very tight on their inventory in this go around. At least that's what I've discovered in our neck of the woods.
And it's true across the country, Jim. The builders, by and large, are not building on spec. Among other things, they can't get the financing for it because the people that financed the last round got burned pretty badly. We are seeing a disproportionate share of new construction dedicated toward multifamily building instead of single-family homes. In fact, it's the opposite problem from the one we had in the early 2000s when people were overbuilding. There is probably latent demand for new homes that's simply not being met right now because, as I think I mentioned earlier, the new home inventory across the country is at nearly a 40-year low. It is starting to come back a little bit, but that's one of the things that will start to generate more buying activity and probably will free up some of those lower-priced properties that aren't on the market right now because those homeowners have nowhere to move.
Wow. All right. Well, listen, Rick, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, how could they do so?
We have a blog that we publish. We have something new up there almost every day at 10x.com. That's www.10-x.com. Or follow me on Twitter at Rick Sharga or LinkedIn, and I post things about our company and about the housing market there pretty regularly.
Rick, well, listen, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. So it sounds like, at least right now, the housing market is still healthy. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure.
You know, it's important to remember, Jim, that for many, many people, real estate is the one big asset that they tend to have. And it preserves value, as a matter of fact, through a financial crisis. So the whole issue of real estate and how you plan to include it in retirement plans is really important.
Yeah, it really is. Because, you know, one of the things I had to discuss with Joe is his roommate, which was a friend of both him and Edna. I mean, she's going to have to go find and live with her children because that's her only choice. Because, you know, in this case, Joe simply could not afford the extra $3,000 a month for that extra one bedroom to support a friend of both he and his deceased wife. It just wasn't a reality. There just wasn't the funds to do that. And so that was what he was going to have to basically tell his friend, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to go back to a one bedroom and, you know, you're going to have to find some place to live and it can't be with me because I can no longer afford to pay this. It's rather interesting because speaking with my guest this week, Rick Sharga, it's one of the trends we're starting to see here, John, in some of the new housing developments. I always like to go out on weekends sometimes and take a look at these new housing developments. You know, I always track what's going on in real estate, talking to the builders, lenders, what are the trends? Is buying still remaining strong, which it is? And one of the new trends we're seeing in homes here is multiple dwellings. In other words, you know, converting sort of a guest house. One development around here has a guest house option on the property. You're seeing garages that can be converted into separate living expenses with a kitchenette and a separate entrance. So this is a trend, not only millennials living at home, but also parents taking care of their parents. And that's a trend that's going to persist, John. And as Rick talked about, it is becoming a bigger and trend. We're going to see much more of it in the future. Well, in the meantime, we're out of time here on Lifetime Income. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.